At public hearing scheduled on Senate Bill 263 and 264, which both are concerned with agricultural labor. And so I'll open up a public hearing on 263, but I think if interest of time, that if you have comments on 264 too, we'll incorporate them into the same time. And so, Senator Gordley, are you ready? Perhaps Mr. Dodson would like to give a brief summary of it. We'll open a public hearing on 263 with the proviso that we're going to be considering 264L, so for the interest of time.
Senate Bill 263, it applies meal and rest periods to individuals employed in agricultural labor. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact. A statement has been issued.
What is 264? Is it
264 would applies overtime rules to individuals employed in agricultural labor.
Okay, very good. Senator Gordley, welcome. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Committee on Business and Labor. It is a privilege and a pleasure to be before you this afternoon to comment on Senate Bills 263 and 264. For the record, I am Avelle Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Portland. And joining me, Mr. Chair, are Mr. Steve Woody, Mr. Ramon Ramirez, Mr. Michael Dale, who are joining me as a part of a panel presentation on these two bills this morning. I believe there are a couple of other people who will also be providing testimony as well. But to set the a framework for what we will be talking about, Mr. Chair, in these two bills, I would draw you to Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution, which states, and I quote, "No law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which upon the same terms shall not equally belong to all citizens," end of quote. Yet, Mr. Chair, the fact is that Oregon statutes specifically exclude workers in Oregon's agricultural industry from the protections and rights of many laws. Among those laws that have been passed contrary to both the letter and spirit of Article 1, Section 20, are laws granting rights to all Oregon workers except agricultural industry workers. These laws specifically and arbitrarily exclude Oregon's agricultural industry workers from meal and rest breaks and from the right to overtime pay. These laws, additionally, violate basic human rights and create in statute a separate underclass of workers throughout Oregon who are routinely denied equal protection under the law. Oregon laws grant meal and rest periods for the preservation of the health of employees. Senate Bill 263 brings those laws into compliance with Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution. Oregon laws grant overtime pay to employees as just compensation for their labor. Senate Bill 264 brings those laws into compliance with Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution. Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Committee on Business and Labor, I urge you to hold a work session on both of these bills and to send them to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation, which will signal our intent to include all of Oregon's workers in the protections that our Constitution affords. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of the Senator? I think you have a committee meeting.
I do have a committee, Mr. Chair, the Health and Human Services Committee, but I'm available if you should have...
What room are you in?
I'm in Hearing Room F, the Ways and Means Human Services Committee, if you should have further questions.
Okay. Sounds very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And my thanks to the panelists who made themselves available to come and help enlighten all of you about the importance of this legislation. Thank you.
Good. Well, welcome. Please introduce yourself.
All right. Ramon Ramirez, for the record, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am president of Northwest Tree Planters and Farm Workers United, Oregon's Farm Worker Union. And on behalf of our over 5,000 members, we stand in strong support of both Senate Bill 263 and 264. We believe that the time has come for our state to recognize farm workers, that they deserve a right to meal breaks and rest breaks and for overtime. For too long, farm workers have not been given this right. Not only are farm workers America's lowest paid workers, averaging $7,500 annually, but suffers numerous other health problems related to occupational health and safety issues. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, agriculture is one of the most accident-prone industries in the United States. I've included some information in my testimony so that you can go into more statistics related to the health and safety issues of farm workers. Farm worker hours, work hours, accommodate the crops and not vice versa. Their work is often requires soup labor, working the soil, climbing, carrying heavy loads, and direct contacts with plants. We believe that there's a strong correlation between farm worker industry injuries and health conditions due to the fact that farm workers are not getting sufficient rest periods. We believe that Senate Bill 263 and 264 is a step in the right direction and should be passed into law. We urge members of the committee to pass both proposals. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much. Questions? Well, let's go through the panel first. Welcome, and please introduce yourself.
I'm Reverend Stephen Witte. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Farm Worker Ministry. We are an advocacy group of faith-based individuals working with and on behalf of farm workers, primarily in the Willamette Valley. Excuse me. It has been our experience in working with farm workers in the valley that we've seen that frequently that they are subject to working long hours in the heat of the day in the sun without adequate periods to stop, adequately get water, to take other necessary breaks that would be necessary for normal good health. And as been mentioned, with their contact with various agricultural chemicals and various other environmental issues, that this constitutes a public safety issue for their own well-being. And then I think the other thing is a time that we need to look at is where we are as a people. Here we are on the threshold of the 21st century, and in many ways we're operating on rules that were established in the last century, particularly with some of the wage and hour rules. But then the whole agricultural rule system and work schedules were products of you know, the 15th and 16th centuries. So I think that at this time in Oregon, we're at a very good place to really look at where we are in a way to maintain competitiveness, but also in a way to honor the dignity of each and every individual that's working in our fields. We certainly have a good product, but we would hate that product to be tainted by poor labor practices. Certainly that's from the average consumer starting to look at how these products are being produced, and by a computer and other means of communication, people are much more aware of labor practices in various parts of the country and the world. And I will cite, for example, the work that's been done by the Immokalee workers in Florida and the Taco Bell protests and campaigns that they've mounted internationally. So consumers are taking an interest in how the product gets to their tables and the products that they purchase. And certainly I would hate to see the wonderful products that we produce here in the Willamette Valley, the berries, fruits, vegetables, so forth, to have that kind of taint, that they might be wonderful products, but they're tainted by poor labor practices. So I would urge the passage of both of these bills that they become a part of Oregon law. I think it's the just thing to do, and I think it's the righteous thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I'm with the Northwest Worker Justice Project, a new advocacy organization dedicated to the interests of low-wage and immigrant workers. For about 25 years, I was a migrant lawyer in Oregon, and the last 17 or so years, I directed the work of migrant lawyers either at Oregon Law Center or previous to that at Oregon Legal Services. During all that time, on an almost annual basis, we set priorities among farm workers about the most important problems to them. And one thing that sort of came up again and again and again, and we were never able to address in any meaningful way, is the question of rest periods and breaks. Because Oregon law has, for the most part, excluded farm workers from the coverage of rest period and breaks. I say for the most part because it's interesting that for a period of, I don't remember, it's 2 or 4 years in the middle 80s, farm workers are actually covered by this regulation. And then it was repealed. And it was repealed not based upon an argument that it was economically burdensome or that it was impractical or anything like that. It was repealed on the basis that the Attorney General apparently came up with a theory that it might be outside of the authority of the Commissioner of Labor to promulgate such a rule for workers in agriculture. This issue came up in the impetus for Senate Bill 263 came up at the end of the last session in a hearing chaired actually by Senator Beyer in this committee. And in this committee, the topic of the hearing wasn't just rest periods and breaks or overtime or anything like that. It was the state of agriculture and agricultural labor. And a whole parade of industry witnesses came in, and one after another represented to the committee, correctly I think, that responsible agricultural employers already provide rest periods and breaks, and that it was the practice in the industry to do so. And based upon that, an effort was made to ask Commissioner Roberts to adopt a regulation that incorporated agricultural workers. He chose not to do that primarily on the basis of cost, without really any showing that there is an adverse cost. In fact, I would argue quite to the contrary, that the cost would be negligible and maybe positive. Rest periods for farm workers working in the field aren't just an issue of convenience or dignity, although they are those things. It's also a matter of being able to get to the field sanitation that we've required to be in the fields, to be able to relieve oneself in dignity and wash your hands and then go back to pick the crops. Now, if you can't do that, the net result is the spread of communicable diseases, the indignity of people needing to relieve themselves in the field, and in 1986 this legislature held extensive hearings on that and ultimately strengthened the field sanitation requirements. And it leads to urinary tract infections, heat exhaustion, and other kinds of problems. Agriculture doesn't need that, and I think that those leaders of the agriculture industry that testified that it's the standard practice among good employers to provide rest periods and breaks were quite right, and it was in their economic interest to do so. And I'd call upon this legislature to remove any impediment legally to having the Commissioner of Labor do that. That's on Senate Bill 263. On Senate Bill 264, the overtime provision, no doubt you will hear from some who will say that this is inordinately expensive at a time when agriculture is very stressed. And the agricultural economy is not at its best. I would like to present to the committee a way of looking at this that perhaps it's not as as burdensome as it might seem at first. The historical basis of the exclusion of farm workers from agriculture really comes out of the New Deal. In the Fair Labor Standards Act, the federal act that provides for overtime, farm workers were excluded. And they weren't excluded for policy reasons. They were excluded because the Southern Dixiecrats were part of the New Deal and basically took the attitude that in the industrial North you can do whatever you want, but don't mess around with our field workers. And this is really just a remnant of that. If you think about it, there are many, many circumstances where there is a high need for workers, where there are long, demanding hours, and where we nonetheless require people to pay overtime for hours worked over 40 hours a week. The tourist industry fits that category. The timber industry fits that category. Closer to agriculture, food processing, after the berries come off the vines, they go to a cannery where those berries have to be processed promptly, and overtime is a fact of life there. I think it's important to keep in perspective that this bill would not require anyone to pay time and a half. What it would require employers to do is to manage labor in a way that made it unnecessary for people to work the long hours and maybe made more jobs available to more people, and that would be beneficial for agricultural workers. And if you manage work that way, it would not require more payroll than you're currently paying. The problem we have in agriculture is agriculture workers are treated as kind of a very cheap and expendable commodity, and so we organize work in agriculture around other interests, marketing interests or other interests, rather than providing good quality jobs. And a job where you work a very short period of time, huge number of hours, and then don't have a job is not a very desirable job in the long run. And to the extent that we can put Oregon in a public policy perspective of providing policy incentives to organize longer terms of employment for more hours over the long run rather than a whole lot of hours in a very, very tight timeline, that's better. Now, people will say, well, that's impossible in agriculture, and to some extent with some crops in some circumstances it may be. But there are techniques that really address that, some of which we haven't probably even thought of, but some of which are in operation now. And I'll give you one example that I used to give as sort of a way out there example that now is a very much part of a reality in the orchard industry. And that is, you know, we used to grow thinly planted, really big, tall trees, which meant that you needed to have a harvest workforce to go up and down ladders. You had to have a huge number of workers in a short period of time. Techniques have been developed where by pruning and thicker, denser planting, you basically grow your orchard almost like a shrub. Everything is kind of close to the ground. It's trained along trellises so that basically the harvest is from the ground. You don't have people falling out of trees, and you don't have nearly the labor demand of a short, intensive harvest. The price you pay for that is a lot of pruning and training work, which creates longer jobs over a longer period of time, which is a better situation for agricultural workers. Now, that won't work on every farm, and it won't work in every industry, but to the extent that we place in place some policy incentives in that direction, it would be beneficial for agricultural workers, certainly, and for the agricultural industry itself in the long run. Thank you. I'd take any questions you have.
Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. You're coming. We have Eileen. Patrick Green. This is Patrick?
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Both of you. Eileen, too.
Oh, okay.
Both of you come up, please. We're talking about both 263 and 264.
I'll go ahead.
All right.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Patrick Green. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I won't get into as much detail as the previous panel, but just would like to register our support for Senate Bill 264 and Senate Bill 263. And basically, I'd like to echo what was said about the fact that a lot of this legislation or these standards were first laid out during the New Deal. And you could go either way on that. One, the exemption for agricultural workers, but also the hard-fought 8-hour day and 40-hour week. And I think that this comes down to a fundamental fairness issue. I think that if you asked the average Oregonian Oregonian or the vast majority of Oregonians, should people who work get a rest period? I think they'd say yes. And I think if you ask the average person, should people have some time away from work to eat their lunch, to have a meal, they'd also say yes. And I think by virtue of the fact that the previous testimony talked about how most employers already provide that, speaks to that people believe that that's a fundamental, it's just fair, it's just a fundamental fairness issue. I think on the other, so that's for Senate Bill 263. For Senate Bill 264 on the issue of overtime, I'd like to echo what the previous panel said about it doesn't establish a time and a half, it just establishes that that there would be some sort of standard related to overtime. And I think, again, that's a societal thing that we've decided on. We've decided that people who work overtime, who work over 8 hours a day or over 40 hours in a week, are making a sacrifice for their employer. They're sacrificing time away from their family, time away from their kids, and that they should get some sort of premium for that sort of work. And so I think that we should extend that to farm workers as well, because they are spending time away from their families, time away from their kids, as a result of working overtime. We ought to respect that. Thanks for your time.
Please introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Eileen O'Malley, and I'm currently an attorney with the Migrant Farm Worker Program of the Oregon Law Center. I first worked with the Migrant Farm Worker Program when it was then part of Oregon Legal Services in 1991. Prior to that, I earned a doctorate in Mexican history, and I have, in effect, many years of both academic and knowledge and practical exposure to the problems faced by agricultural labor. I'd also like to say that I come from a family of miners and ditch diggers. My own father was a ditch digger. And I know what it's like to live in a home where work destroys the parents, where work destroys bodies, and for all the hard work is done after a lifetime, there is really nothing to show for that work except what's left of, you know, the overworked body. As a farm worker attorney, I am repeatedly approached by farm workers who complain that they do not get breaks, that they do not get to take lunch, that they do not get to take dinner, that they work 70 hours a week, sometimes even more at the peak of the harvest season. Most recently, I've been working a case that involves 60 workers who work 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, with no lunch, week in, week out. These workers come to us thinking this is illegal, that there must be a way, that they have to be allowed to have breaks, that they have to be allowed to eat lunch, that they should get some extra money for overtime that they put in, the extra hours that they put in. They think this because all around them they see people in other work who get that. Their friends work in offices, their friends work in restaurants, their friends work in factories, and they get overtime and they get breaks. They do not understand how it is that they work longer, harder, in more grueling conditions, and are not entitled to these same rights. I think it is, at the simplest level, a humanitarian duty to extend the same rights to the workers who work the hardest. I also think it's well to point out in these difficult economic times that we are not speaking of a handout. We are speaking of people who work extra, who go an extra mile, who give the very last drop of their energy so that the berries are come in, so that the crop is planted. They do all these things. The cows get milked. They go extra, and I think it is fitting and just that their pay reflects an extra amount in accordance with the extra amount of labor that they have given. For all these reasons, I urge you to pass Senate Bill 263 and 264.
Questions? Yes,
Senator. Excuse me, but you talked about some of the people you've been working with on this, and that you said do not get meal breaks and overtime, etc. So do I take that to mean they're prevented from doing that? I mean, I'd like to hear some specifics of who is preventing them from, especially the rest periods and the lunch periods. I mean, is this something that they're told that when they're working for that employer that they are not allowed to take rest periods or lunch periods?
In some instances, that's what happens, yes. Of course, there are some employers who permit this, but it is permission at the behest or the goodwill of the employer. There are many employers who simply do not permit it. If you even stop to go to the bathroom, the supervisor will be standing outside the shed telling you to hurry up. And if you can't, you have to leave and go back to the field, or your life will be made miserable, or you won't make your picking quota and you won't work again. And there are many cases where lunch is kind of what can you stuff in your face as you're being moved from the strawberry field over to the blueberry field. There is no time when you're allowed to stop and eat, which is the definition of a meal break, that you get time away from your duties in which you cannot be made to work and you're allowed to eat.
Just follow, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Just quick. Would you be able to provide the committee with some of those farms that are doing that? I mean, I'd like to have specific rather than anecdotal information. Can you provide us with some of those farms that have been inhibiting workers from doing those things?
I really can't say whether I could. I certainly would not feel comfortable doing it right at this moment. At this point, I'm involved in cases, and I don't think it would be appropriate in a public forum to give these names out. I could...
You mean legal cases?
Yes.
So that would be public record, then, if they're legal cases, so you could direct us to that.
The cases are not yet filed. I would be happy to speak to you afterwards and to speak with my own supervisors to see what kind of information we could provide you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Commissioner Gardner. We're testifying about 263 and 264.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and my apologies for being a little bit late. I've discovered that when you're in the House, you're generally 15 minutes late. In the Senate, it's 30. Statewide, it's 45, so just so you wanted to know. Well, see, I try to set a better example than the other five. That's all there is to it, Senator Beyer. Anyway... on Senate Bill, I'm here to testify in favor of both Senate Bill 263 and 264. Senate Bill 263 simply requires, the standard of meal and rest periods for agriculture workers, the same as other workers throughout the state enjoy. To be honest with you, I believe from our conversations with the Attorney General's office that the Bureau has the authority to put this into rule rather than to put it through statute. However, having said that, there is an arguable point on both sides, and it's my belief that without this legislation that we would end up in costly litigation that would cost the state a lot of money if we were to impose that rule. And I would certainly think that it would be much better for the legislature and for the Bureau if we were to pass the bill so that there was absolute crystal clear clarity within the law. I believe every worker is entitled to have those rest periods. I've heard others say that that farm workers don't necessarily want meals and rest periods. And I have to tell you, from a personal standpoint, I find it very hard to believe that someone would want to eat a sandwich while out in the fields picking crops that are generally very close to the earth and have an awful lot of chemicals on them. And although from talking to our farm labor unit, there are many employers who are very good employers who do give meals and rest periods, there are a number that do not, and Senator Besker, I'd be happy to talk to them and see if we can come up with some examples and some specific employers that we know have had a history of not providing those meals and rest periods. I think this is something that all workers are entitled to have just 15 minutes to take a rest, a breather, a break, particularly such back-breaking work as agriculture work tends to be out in the hot sun and, as I said, exposed to many hazardous chemicals. During my campaign for Labor Commissioner, I toured many of the agricultural facilities where they do put their workers through chemical training in the very early parts, the very first part, and before they hire them, go out in the field, and they are exposed to an awful lot of hazards. To have the ability to go wash up, clean yourself off a little bit and have a meal is just something that should be allowed to any worker out there. They deserve that decency and respect. As to the 40-hour work week bill in Senate Bill 264, it's been my long-standing belief that the 40-hour work week should be something that is every worker goes through, because the intent of overtime back when the 40-hour work week was first passed by Congress many, many years ago is that if an employer is to hire a worker and have them work beyond 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, where that worker is away from their spouse, their family, and from that family time they should be spending together, they should pay a premium for that so that it's further of benefit to the family. And I've been a strong believer of that all my life as a worker myself, and I think that agriculture workers absolutely deserve this right like other workers out there, Senator. So I would urge passage of both of these bills.
Would you include legislators in all that too? Is it your overtime?
Actually, I'd like to get them included in the minimum wage when I was a legislator here. It'll start with there and go upwards.
About 8 hour days. How many hours did you work last week?
Oh my gosh, at least 6 days.
I guess we fall legally under the salaried category rather than the hourly, Senator. So.
I guess there's a difference.
Statewide's aren't much different, so you ought to see my travel schedule.
Imagine.
My name is Christine Hammond. For the record, I'm the director of the Bureau of Labor and Industries Wage and Hour Division, and I'm just here to answer any technical questions you have about enforcement of the rest and meal period provisions or overtime laws.
Oh, I do have a question.
Yes.
Could you clarify something for me? Because, not being an attorney, but I was reading this stuff, it pertains to both, but on 264 and on line 29, where it says the amendments to this exception apply to overtime work by individuals employed in agriculture labor on or after the effective date. And then just before that, it says applies to individuals in agriculture as defined by 57.045. And I was just reading 657.045 to see, okay, who this, who is agricultural labor, and it has these whole standards, like it's you have to be paying at least $20,000 or more in a quarter during a year, and on each of any 20 days you've had to employ 10 or more individuals. So do I read this to then that this would apply to, this would not apply to small family farms, and only because it says you're employed only if this employer has a larger subsets. Am I reading that wrong? Because that's what it says. This is what employment is.
Senator Metzger, Chair Nelson, we follow the definition of the U.S. Department of Labor for agricultural workers, and it's a very broad definition. Frankly, I haven't compared the difference between that definition and 657.045. I believe it would cover all traditionally thought of agricultural workers. Agricultural workers who are employed in manufacturing settings are currently exempt under the agricultural definition, so that's one difference I can think of. But we could do a side-by-side comparison and let you know what other differences there might be between this particular statutory definition and the one we currently apply.
I just would be interested because it just says when it defines agricultural employment 4045, it says during any calendar quarter in the current calendar year or the preceding calendar year, paid remuneration in cash of $20,000 or more, or each of 20 days employed 10 or more. So I was wondering that, so that you're not technically in agriculture, employed by agriculture, if you work for someone who is engaged in something less than that. That's how I read that. And I was just curious to make sure that we know who we might be covering or not covering.
I'll get you some information back on that.
Okay.
I have a question. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either of you could answer this. Is Oregon unusual in its treatment of agricultural workers for denying them a rest break and a meal period?
Senator Walker, Senator Nelson, No, we're not unusual. There are some states that treat agricultural workers the same as other workers, but there are also states that have similar exemptions. And I don't have all that information, but I could probably get you a list of states that fall under those particular categories.
Yeah, if you would, I'd actually like to see that. And I'm particularly interested in other states who have an agricultural emphasis and how long they've been doing it.
Certainly.
Okay. Very good. Any questions?
Sure.
Lesson?
Yes,
okay. Good. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We don't have anybody else signed up for this, and what there are some bills coming over from the House, evidently. Oh, Senator Breyer.
Mr. Chair, as an agriculture employer in the state, I think that there's reasons why this has been this way in the past, and one of which I could like to respond to is that I have workers who work for me that, because I do offer meal times and break periods, and they don't want meal times because those are unpaid meal times. They would rather work. They would rather eat their lunch as they're going from one field to another, so they can get paid for initial hours during the day, because this is a time-sensitive crop and crops. I disagree with what Mr. Dale said about that you can extend these time periods. I grow Christmas trees. It's hard. You can't even give them away on the 26th of December. I haven't figured out yet a way, unless we can get people to convince people to buy Christmas trees for maybe Valentine's Day or something. I haven't figured out a way yet that we can extend the period of time that we can harvest our Christmas trees. So that's one very good reason, is that, and I, many, many workers of mine, they do not want to take a meal break because it will cost them a half hour of time that they can be getting paid for. And the issue of overtime, again, we have the same issue. They are, many of the migrant workers, not all, many of them, some of them, at least ones that worked for me in the past, they are here, they want to get as many hours as they possibly can. And if an employer has got to manage his workforce in order to be competitive, because we are competing not against other employers in the state of Oregon, we are competing against employers in other states. Almost all of them have lower minimum wages than ours are. If we, and I don't know, I'd be interested to get the list of other states who require agricultural workers to be paid overtime, because my understanding is that if there are some, there are very few, and we would be put at a further disadvantage, competitive disadvantage, because, and our workers don't want to be limited to 40 hours a week and then have to go out and we have to, are forced to find other workers, because we do have to work, you know, 10 to 12 hours a day, 7 days a week during our harvest time. And if we are forced to have two shifts, so to speak, the workers are going to be getting less hours. And the workers that I've worked for me don't want that, because I've done that in the past to try to cut my own costs down. And it's very difficult if you're not willing to offer employers, you know, 60 or 70 employees, 60 or 70 hours a week. They don't want to work for you because they can go to a farm where they can get that kind of those kind of hours. And they would prefer that because they want to earn as much as they possibly can. The final point I'd like to make is that there's a bill coming over from the House, very similar to a bill that was passed in Special Session 2 and vetoed by the governor, that would allow, or, you know, for all, to get rid of the exemption for collective bargaining for farms. And all of these issues could be dealt with in that manner if that's the case. So I guess people who want to see this happen should be supporting the bill to eliminate the exemption for unionization of farm workers, and then this issue could be handled on a farm-by-farm basis. With that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Any further comments? I was the situation I understood too is there's a bill coming over from the House. We wanted to keep this live. Senator Gordley requested that we have this hearing, and with respect for her, and the issue is a very important issue, and we're going to continue to work it. We'll see what comes out of the House, and we have a deadline to hear bills before April 11th, so we're here. So thank you. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 263, open up public hearing 264, and for the record indicate that we took testimony on 264 during the course of the testimony 263, and we'll close public hearing on 264. Open up a work session on 341, is that right? Work session on Senate Bill 341. Mr. Dusk.
Senate Bill 341 excludes employment listing services from definition of employment agency and declares emergency effective July 1, 2003. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and there are dash two amendments that were provided to the committee just moments before we started.
Mr. Chair, as these amendments were just handed to me during lunch, and in fact, the proponents of the bill have not seen them yet, as far as I know. I know the Labor Commissioner is here and his staff is here, but I don't think anyone has seen the amendments with the exception of us, and I haven't had a chance to look at them, so I would ask that this be held over for a couple days so the amendments can be thoroughly gone through and make sure they do what everyone wants, because there is a complete agreement among the Labor Commissioner and the proponents of the bill. It's just they want to make sure that technically the amendments are correct.
Okay, very good. Any disagreement or controversy with that, we'll continue the work session and hold it over, and so we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 341. Open up work session on 335.
Senate Bill 355 requires that certain stores require identification of individuals from whom stores purchase used goods, requires stores to keep specified information about each purchase of used goods, makes failure to require identification and keep records subject to a maximum fine of $300, and there are dash one amendments, which would ensure that the authority of any county, city, or district ordinance regulating the resale of goods, used goods, is not preempted by this bill.
Okay, very good. Mark, would you like to come up and just see you're signed up to testify? We can talk about the dash ones. It says here that you're reasonably happy if you have dash ones.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. The chair has accurately characterized the city's position with the Dash 1 amendments. Our concern had been that the penalty contained in the bill would have preempted local governmental authority to impose penalties on secondhand stores for poor records keeping if we have ordinances within our own jurisdictions. I believe the Dash 1 amendment would take care of that concern, and we'd certainly be supportive of the bill with the dash one.
Okay, very good. Questions? Discussions on the dash ones? We are in a work session, didn't I do that?
Yes, we are, Mr. Chair. So I would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 355.
Any discussion? Any disagreement? Let the record show that Senator Meyer had a previous commitment, and he'll be back as soon as he possibly can, so he's excused for this vote. There's no objections. The motion for the to approve the Dash 1 amendments is approved. And
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 355 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, questions, objections? So ordered. And we have Jenny Burdick, I think, would love to carry that bill. Senator Burt, went up a work session on Senate Bill 822. And this is a bill, remember, we gave the folks some time to work things out. They worked things out, and then they found out in the what clause am I talking about in there? It's the regarding clause.
The relating clause.
Yes, the relating clause was too narrow in this bill, and so there's another bill in the House.
I remember this bill.
And so what we've decided to do is just send this bill out as it is, as it was written, without changing it, and then they can work on that bill in conjunction with the other bill in the House, which has a broader relating clause. And evidently, they have come to an agreement, and so they are going to work it out over there. So.
So the elements in this bill, as I recall, they were okay with. There were some additional things.
There was a licensing.
The additional will then be in the other.
Yeah, it was a licensing and permitting issue. So, this thing also has a referral to Ways and Means, and we're going to ask the Senate President to rescind that and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And so the chair would move that we pass Senate Bill 822 to the floor to the President's office with a recommendation to rescind the referral to Ways and Means. And then a subsequent movement to the floor with a due pass recommendation. So that's what the chair has moved. Any questions? Any problems? Any objections? So ordered, and I can carry that one.
It is your bill.
It is your bill, yes.
It is my bill. Oops, wait, I just...
someone to testify.
I did have somebody from Tim Nicole. Tim, where are you? Are you here? Come on up real quick, like we'll reopen that work session.
I don't mean to take any of your time. Senator Nelson, committee, my name is Tim Nicole. I'm with the International Brotherhood of Electric Workers, Local 280. I live in Junction City, but I represent 1,150, some of the best-trained electrical workers in seven counties. Just real quickly, I just wanted to let you know that I'm new to this process, and I admit that, but I've been working on defining this telecommunications issue now for 3 years due to some of the antiquated language that's in the existing statute. Last week, we got together with two work groups, and everybody was in agreement. We had it all ironed out. And I just wanted to let you know that I'm really disappointed in politics right now, because I found out this morning there's a little trick that some lobbyists use that where they can request something to do with the relating clause, and that's what happened in this situation. And I think that the citizens in the state, if that House bill doesn't go through, are not getting a good deal. Thank you very much.
I appreciate your testimony. And there was an issue over the relating clause. And under Senate Bill 822, it's relating to competitive telecommunications providers. And the issue is competitive telecommunications provider. There's only four of them in the state. There's incumbent telecommunications provider that the other bill would also affect. And so we're talking about competitive versus incumbent, and so the bill that you're talking about should be inclusive of all of them, but we were not able to change this relating clause, and so we have to keep it at the competitive, and that only applies to, I think, four companies in the state of Oregon. So the other bill would apply to what are the other 70 or whatever it are incumbent. No, yeah, incumbent. Well, I'm backwards with that, aren't I? I'm backwards. Yeah, I am backwards. Competitive is that's the large one. There's only four incumbent telephone communicators, and that's why we have to use the other bill, because we need to get those incumbents included in that bill. So I appreciate your testimony. Yes?
And, Mr. Chair, I'd like to assure Mr. Nicol, who's my constituent, thank you for coming today. There are commitments that have been made in this building that the House bill will pass, and there's always someone in the center office called the governor who can veto things if those commitments don't happen. So I'll make sure and watch that.
Thank you very much for just listening.
Yeah, thank you for coming. I appreciate it. You'll get used to this process.
I don't know.
Okay, well, thank you, Tim, very much.
I would like to reopen the record.
Yes. Would you like to reopen the record on which bill was that?
822.
822.
Vote aye.
And code and cast a I vote for 822. So we'll close that. So now we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 826.
Mr. Chair, actually, since that one is my bill as well as 833, could we take 833 first? Do you mind?
No, sure. We can recess 826 and we'll open up a public hearing on 833.
I say that because I have a lot of disability advocates who drove up from Eugene,
okay.
and I'd like to get them out of here quickly.
Okay, sounds very good. Okay, well, we have...
I'll get your constituents out of here.
Well, okay, I didn't mean it that way.
Mr. Dodson, on Senate Bill 833.
Senate Bill 833 requires new rental housing receiving certain forms of federal or state funding for construction to incorporate design features to increase visitability by individuals with mobility impairments. There's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. No revenue impact. Has a minimal fiscal impact. No statement issued.
Okay, thank you. Senator Walker, do you want to start this off? And okay. Please introduce yourself and come
on. Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of my committee. It's a pleasure to see you from this side of the dais.
I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator for District 7, and John Van Landingham will introduce himself in a moment. And I've asked John to come up and sit with me because John has been an integral part of this bill and making sure that we get it the way we need to. He's a good person at detail, and he also stays late at his job because on Friday night, Thursday night, we were sending emails back at 8:30, and I told him to go home, and he told me to do the same. So I want to talk to you about the concept of visibility. If we had more time today, I would have shown a video that is really nice that introduces the concept. But I actually have real people here who are mobility impaired who can give you that same kind of information that I think will come from the heart and you'll understand. This bill, Senate Bill 833, is actually a repeat of a bill last session in the House, 2172. It passed the House with only 5 dissenting votes and came over here and just sort of sat. So we're starting here on the Senate side. It has been retooled. And basically what you will find with visibility, what it means. You'll have a yellow sheet there in front of you that talks about visibility. And a visitable home is one that has one entrance without a step so that someone in a wheelchair can access the home. Doorways, interior doorways, and the doorway into the home is 32 inches instead of a smaller passageway so that you can get a wheelchair through there. And the video that I would have shown you would have told you that the cost difference is practically negligible in going up to a larger size opening. And then at least a half bath, preferably a full bath on the main floor so that you can have people come in and use the restroom. We've compromised on this bill because this bill applies to housing that uses public funds. And sometimes the kind of land that you have available and the kind of housing that you do, you have to make compromises. And we understood that making a full-service bathroom on the lower floor totally accessible is very expensive, let's put it that way, in some housing situations, because you may have a townhouse where there are stairs going up and the bathroom is right below the stairs and it's hard to get a restroom that you can get your wheelchair in and get completely turned around. So we've at least made the doorway open. And these are the kind of things that we're talking about are really ordinary things that you and I don't even think twice about because we're able-bodied and we can walk into whatever restroom we want. But when you are in a wheelchair and you go to visit someone's home, it really is discouraging when you can't get in the home, first off, and then when you can't even use the restroom. And so you have to think about not drinking anything while you're there visiting because you don't want to need, I have to use the restroom. But I'm going to let my folks from Eugene talk about that. Let me explain, you do have the Dash 1 Amendment, Mr. Dotson, yes, thank you. And the Dash 1 Amendment does replace the entire bill in, other than the preamble that we talk about. And that's been negotiated for months. And John, would you kind of like to explain what each part does, or do you want... Okay, I'm going to let John explain that. And while he's explaining that also, you have in front of you a series of photographs of visitable-type facilities that are built here in Oregon. So I'd like you to look at those. And at this time, I'll let John explain to you how the bill works.
Okay. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Chair Nelson and Senator Beyer. My name is John Van Landingham. I'm a legal services lawyer in Lane County. I do a fair amount of advocacy on behalf of both low-income tenants and for affordable housing. Last session with HB 2172, I would describe myself as a critic of the bill because I thought that it didn't work. about a year ago, disability advocates in Eugene came to a local affordable housing group that I chair that's got a representative from the Eugene City Council, Springfield City Council, Lane County Commission, and private sector folks, and asked us to encourage local governments to pass a visitability requirement. Our response was to say, no, you should go back to Salem, as you did in 2001, and we would work with you to try to make the bill better. We've done that, and that's this bill. We created a work group called the Visitability Work Group, and we met more than 12 times over a seven-month period. And with the Dash 1, this bill does what that group compromised, came to a compromise agreement on. I find in some of my groups that when I talk about visitability, their eyes glaze over. So, and I don't want to go down in history as the visitability wonk. So let me do this very briefly. The bill requires subsidized affordable housing to be visitable, period. It's a mandatory requirement. And it defines subsidized affordable housing as housing financed through the State Housing and Community Services Department. So, if you are an affordable housing developer, whether that's a nonprofit, a housing authority, or a for-profit, and you seek certain funds from the state in its competitive funding cycle, you will have to commit to build those units as visitable. And you will sign a contract with the state, and if you don't do it, there will be financial penalties that the state will assess against you. Senator Walker described what visitable means. Basically, it means being someone in a wheelchair, being able to get into the unit, and get around into the unit and get to the bathroom. There are six basic elements of visitability. One is the exterior route from the street to the front door, to a door. It could be any door. It could be the side door, it could be the back door, but a door. So you've got to be able to get up to the door and through it. That means no lip, and either a ramp or some sort of flush access from the street to the unit. Then it requires at least A1 common living space that's accessible, that in other words it's flat, so that you can get from that accessible doorway to this accessible living space, whether that's the kitchen, living room, den, doesn't matter. One of those spaces has to be flat. Since most affordable housing units don't build sunken living rooms, it's not exactly a problem for affordable housing developers. The third element is an interior route from that front door to that common living space that's accessible and to the bathroom, or what we've called a powder room. The fourth element is that there has to be a powder room. Now, many affordable housing units are simply built on one floor. They're apartments. Some are townhouses. In Lane County, we've actually focused on townhouses because we think they are better received by neighbors and stand up better to use over time and provide a better home. In a townhouse, that means that you would have to have a bathroom on the first floor of the townhouse. We have not required, and this is the primary compromise that the mobility advocates have given here, is we would not require that that bathroom be accessible to someone in a wheelchair. In other words, that a wheelchair could get in, close the door, and maneuver inside the bathroom. We have not required that because there's a huge cost to that, in our views, the affordable housing view. It increases the size by somewhere between 10 to 20 square feet. If you do that on the first floor of a townhouse, you got to do that on the second floor, so you're talking about doubling that square footage on the two floors. It has a significant cost impact to our units. The mobility advocates have compromised by not requiring that. In return, we've agreed that a fifth element would be that somewhere in a complex of 20 units or more, or if there's a community room, there has to be an accessible bathroom, fully accessible bathroom. If there is a community room, building code already requires an accessible bathroom. And then finally, we require that the environmental controls, light switches, heat, those sorts of things, be reachable for somebody in a wheelchair. This is only applicable to rental housing. It's not applicable to homeownership. It's only applicable to subsidized housing through the state that gets certain funding sources. It's not applicable to the state's homeownership programs. It's only applicable to newly built housing. It doesn't apply to existing or conversion or rehabilitated housing. And there are a number of exemptions built in that the Housing and Community Services Department can apply in reviewing these funding requests.
Primarily those are, if in HCS's opinion, the topography of the site makes it impossible to do visitability, whether there are problems with community and design standards, undue costs and constraints, and conflicting public funding requirements. We anticipate that HCS would have to make rules and would negotiate those rules between affordable housing advocates such as me and mobility advocates such as those who are here to talk about the bill.
Okay, very good. Question?
And Mr. Chair, if I might, and members of the committee, this concept was started in 1986 by a woman, Eleanor, I can't think of her last name. She started Concrete Change, and she had polio when she was a child, and she's been in a wheelchair ever since. And this movement just sort of spread across the country. And as we all age in place, we're all baby boomers. I'm looking at all of us, and we look like we're all baby boomers. And we are growing older. We are going to become impaired ourselves in some way, whether it's by fate because something happens to you or whether you have an accident, you're a diabetic, you can't move around anymore, you're mobility impaired. If we start thinking about aging in place and accommodating ourselves when we build these homes, then we're just that much farther ahead of the game. We can't ask the private sector to do this, but we can ask the public sector to show the private market how we can do this and how we can do it affordably.
That brings up a question. In the policy, the state is to encourage the design and construction of dwellings. That's staying in the bill?
Yes.
How does that, you're not requiring that private?
Well, we're encouraging them though, Mr. Chair. We're encouraging the private sector to do that.
If I might add, I mentioned that this issue came before the local affordable housing advocacy group in Eugene, and one of our members is the government relations person for the Lane County Home Builders. She has actually welcomed the concept as long as it's not mandatory, but as a marketing strategy for home builders. For home builders, access through a garage is not a problem. Their units typically have garages, and that's the easiest place to provide a level access. Affordable housing units don't have garages. Secondly, they build large bathrooms, unlike many subsidized apartments. So the primary costs of visitability for a private home builder are minimal. And they see this as a way for them to market homes to baby boomers and to people who expect their parents to come live with them.
In fact, on that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we recently had a tour of homes in Eugene, and there was a visitable home on the tour, and it was in a very upscale neighborhood. So at this time, I'd like you to hear from the visitability advocates.
Okay, well, first I'm going to ask Mr. Repine to come up.
Oh, absolutely. Their department
from the Oregon
has been great.
Housing Commission Authority.
They signed a blast.
Yeah, well, we just have to back with you. I want to get the background here.
Yes, sir. Let me get my information out for you. Information or propaganda?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services, committee members. I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 833. As Senator Walker has indicated, this is, and Mr. Van Landenham has indicated, this has been a bill in process for this session and last session. My agency and my staff played a strong role last session working with then Representative Walker on crafting language to make the bill passable and attainable when it passed through the House, and then for whatever reasons it was not able to sink through the rest of the building. What you've been handed out is actually what I thought when hearing the initial idea of visibility and being part of that population that is growing older and probably will be faced with some of these challenges, to see what we could do relative to just putting it in some of our standards, just on the idea of for people to consider visitability. And I think that this document actually is an interesting report. And I'm not saying this to discredit to not use the bill, quite frankly, but I think the opportunity is there. And what you see is we put just a reference to visitability and just lightly touched on what that meant by getting into the building through at least one opening, having a front door that would be accessible at least 32 inches in width, and a bathroom that would be accessible to the extent of getting through the door, and having switches and other thermostatic controls at a reasonable height. You can see of the number of units that we did in our funding cycles, and these would be the funding cycles that would be eligible. These are the projects that would be eligible under the way this bill is written. So this is the pool of resources that would come into play of the, as you can see at the bottom, of the 1,864 that were funded in 2002. There was a requirement of 290 to meet the federal or current accessibility laws, which means out of every 10 units you have to have, one of them has to be accessible. So that is kind of the built-in minimum threshold for all these. But as you go down this list also, you can see where applicants, nonprofit organizations, for-profit, housing authorities, felt that the visitable process did make sense. And they tried to, in every application, in many applications, to try to add that to as an added value to their development. So in case here, in the important cases, you can see that not only did we get the 290 that would have been required under the law, federal law, we got a total, including that 290, of 797, almost 500, over 500 more units meeting the criteria of visitable that now Senator Walker's bill is addressing. So I guess my more editorial comment is that if on the willingness of people to do this, I hope and I suspect that you will see that number be enhanced. We have not found in all these applications where anybody has found it so onerous that they obviously chose to not to do it. I think the housing advocates who are involved in this realizes the urgency and the necessity of the changing of the faces of citizens in the state of Oregon, and how we need to try to adapt our living conditions to make sure that we can get people through. One of the arguments that we have heard, and it's really kind of an anecdotal one to some degree, and people say, what's the cost? And the cost is really hard to put your hand on because it really depends at the time when you're designing it. If you design it right and address the things right, then as you're building it, really doesn't cost you anything more. It's always if you had to go back and do it after the fact, then you find that the costs become more intolerable. I was trying to think as I was sitting in the audience of a couple examples where that we in Oregon have taken upon the state to make the decisions that are a greater emphasis on public safety particularly. And I can think of two instances where we've changed. And you could say, well, was it worth it? And I think at the end of the day, most of you, including myself, would say it was probably a fair trade-off. Back in the early 80s, bedroom windows did not have to be required to be more than 48 inches off of the floor. And then we changed the law because of fire access issues and the ability for people to get out. So we had to go to windows that were extensively a foot lower to get to a 42-inch window sill height and have so many square feet of window to access out the window. So for some practical reason, we actually added cost to the cost of construction as we knew it in the days prior to make sure that there was a way for citizens to be able to get out of their bedrooms in case there was a fire. So that's one of those trade-offs we made for a cost versus an advantage to the safety of our citizens. We have also done that in a variety of other areas where the discussion has been is, you know, in the best interest of the residents who are going to be living there, is it more practical to make these changes versus subjecting public to some things that could be more challenging. Probably the other example would be is when the codes first came in, we did not require side glasses and or glass glazing that was in within 18 inches of the floor to be tempered. And it was proven and shown that when you don't have tempered glass that low and people have a tendency to run into it, people become more injured because the glass will shatter and you know, possibly cut somebody. So again, the code was changed to accommodate tempered glass within 18 inches of the floor. Again, it has a higher cost. One could argue glass is glass. I can see through it. But the reality is that the tempered glass now would be a superior product in case somebody did have that unfortunate accident. So those were cost decisions that were made in the building industry to accommodate livability and the quality of life for people. So under that same pretense, I think you see this visibility application being presented to you today. There's nothing, I can't find anybody who says it's a wrong idea. I think you find people say, I don't understand why I've got to do it. And the industry as a whole is a very difficult one to change. The building industry is the building industry, and by gosh, they've done it for 20 years one way, and they're not going to do it any different. But as time goes on, changes have to be made. I think this change, in particularly in light of the commitment that the state of Oregon makes to funding housing, as you see in this list of 1,864 units in the period of 2002, that roughly translates to probably, I would guess, around 1.2 billion dollars worth of construction in that range. And it just shows you that's a big investment we're making, and it's our inventory. It's to the extent that we own the mortgage on it, and if we are going to be the stewards of the investments for the state of Oregon, then making sure that all Oregonians have an opportunity to reside in these facilities, I think, is extremely important. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll take any questions.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Mr. Refine for his department. They have been just tremendous to work with both last session and this session, and I just can't say enough about the good stewardship we have at that department under property plan.
So this has no general fund impact?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, we have did a revenue impact of $8,000, and I think in the fiscal sheet you'll see that it really is it comes from two areas. One is the writing of the administrative rules to get this constituted, and that will take some time, obviously, and there's legal fees that have to be involved with that. There will be, we think, as we get our partners up to speed on this, some time where our architects will have to go out and review applications where the person might be suggesting that they need not to be subject to this, the opportunity to release themselves from the visitability component, either totally or partially thereof. So it could be some time for us to get that. But again, we're only pricing it out at $8,000. We think it's, other than those two activities, it's pretty much a normal way of doing business for us in many of our normal day-to-day activities.
Did you absorb that within your own agency?
No.
And you're going to have to fight with the folks down in Ways and Means, even for $8,000, the way it sounded like this year.
Well, again, when we get down to the bottom, down over to the Ways and Means process, I'm sure we'll have this discussion. But currently, it's not, not being flippant, I should say that it isn't in our current budget. We have priced it, so it is actually a moderate price. Historically, at least in my knowledge of this building, when revenue impacts were less than, I think, $50,000, they were able to actually go to the floor. But maybe in your environment today, that's not the case. So we'll see. As to the, I don't think that the fiscal impact would be enough to stand in the way of this, quite frankly.
Okay. Questions? Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Panel three, Stuart, Ellen, and Ed. Can you just kind of... Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, my name is Stuart Branham. I'm a resident of Corvallis, Oregon, and I'm a member of the Oregon Disability Commission as a commissioner. And I'm here today to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 833, Visibility. As you can see, I'm impaired. I can't walk. And about 20 years ago, I bought a home here in Corvallis, and I bought a home that was one story. My family, my kids could come into this home, walk off the driveway, make one step up, and they were in the house. We have two bathrooms on the main floor. There's no second floor. About 3 years ago, I became disabled. I can no longer walk. And lo and behold, this house was built for me. It was perfect. I didn't have to move. I have a small 6-inch ramp to go up the front door, and after that, I'm home free. I can go into all my bathrooms, my bedroom, my living room. I have the only house that my friends can come visit me. I cannot visit them at all because I cannot get in their house. I cannot get into bathrooms. I'm at a complete loss. The first thing that happens after they invite me over is I say, how many steps up to your house? How can I get in your house? Do you have a bathroom on the first floor? And most of these answers are no. So I'm a prime example of why Senate Bill 833 will work for people with mobility disabilities. The Disability Commission supports this bill. We support it because most of our constituents are in wheelchairs or have some mobility or disability. As noted in the bill, the people that are 85 years or older is the fastest growing population. One of the fastest growing populations, people with disabilities, also fast growing. When people get old, they become disabled, and many of them need wheelchairs. So when you initially start out, you may be a healthy person, but if you reach the age of 85, you probably, most of them, will require some sort of mobility assistance. And so this population is growing by leaps and bounds, and even you folks sitting here today may be in that population. So having a house that has accessibility to it for wheelchairs and for people with mobility problems should be the norm. But we're starting at ground level here, so we think this bill is the beginning. It's a place to start. This bill obviously would increase socialization. In other words, people could visit one another. They would be less confined to their own residence because of what is presently the situation. The first thing after you're invited to someone's house, the first thing you have to ask is, how do I get in? Can I use the bathroom? So if this kind of alterations, I beg your pardon, if these kinds of amenities are built into new homes, then it would enable people to visit one another without having to make expensive modifications later on. Basically speaking, if you would look at my house and look at some of the construction of houses today, you would say that these should be a requirement for all houses. But again, this is just the beginning, so let's start at the beginning. So this Building Commission wholeheartedly supports this bill, Senate Bill 833. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ellen?
Hi, my name is Ellen Bombaro. Chair David Nelson and committee members, I live in Eugene and am a volunteer member of the Lane Council of Government Disability Services Advisory Council and secretary of LILA, which is Lane Independent Living Alliance. I ask that you support the concept of visibility, passing Senate Bill 833 out of your committee with the due pass recommendation. I was the council member who brought the concept of visibility and encouraged the organization to pursue the concept in Oregon. For the record, visibility is a residential housing concept that incorporates minor housing modifications in order that a person with a use of mobility device, such as this wheelchair, can visit others. I won't go into the other details, but visibility is also a worldwide movement. Visibility bills have been passed in Georgia, Illinois, Wisconsin, Vermont, Iowa, Texas, Florida, Arizona, and in March of 1998, Parliament mandated that every new home built in the United Kingdom have sufficiently wide halls, interior doorways, and a downstairs bathroom, and one entrance without a step and other features. And what does the lack of visibility mean to me? I experience it firsthand. I miss out on gatherings of friends, If a friend's party isn't held at my house or a restaurant, I can't go. And this is very frustrating, and I try not to dwell on the negative aspects of these experiences, but I do feel left out. I miss mingling with friends. My disability was caused from a fall off a ladder. Remember that you or a member of your family could find yourself in the need of visibility in a split second. But thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're ready for me already? Well, I have some written testimony that I've already given one to Senator Walker, but I have one for the rest of you here. Hang on a second.
Yeah, that's okay. You can...
Yeah, they'll pass it out.
You just speak from the heart, you know. We have time here.
Yeah,
I'm going to save that down. You don't have.
I'm not going to read from it.
Okay.
I'm a person who is an example of both the aspects of this bill. I have it in my life. Let's put it that way. When I was in a residential care facility, like my parents' home is a ranch type home built on with a step up from the living room to the hall and a step down from the hall to the living room, step up from the garage to the, anyway, my dad had to make ramps, portable ramps. He was 70 or 71. It was quite a deal. And when it got to where he could no longer negotiate those ramps, I had to do it with the walker. I had to get my therapist out there and learn how to take those steps. Then, just about the same time I was able to do it, my mother was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. She went from a cane to a walker to a wheelchair real quick. And the ramps were needed. Now, as the gentleman, as the testimony before me has outlined, we have reached a lot, made a lot of compromises on this, on the bathroom, on the powder room design. We have not asked for it to be accessible. We have only asked for a door wide enough, 32-inch clearance to allow a wheelchair in. It's I don't really have much else to say. The concept of visitability is in the middle between unrestricted living and accessibility. It's a space in the middle. It allows you to go and visit people. It prevents what I call the shut-in syndrome. It's a regressive, it prevents you from always having to say, oh, we'll have to do that at my house because you can't get in anywhere else. Now, I thank you. You have my written testimony. Are there any questions?
I don't have any questions. Thank you all very much. Appreciate
thank you.
Down. Did Ted and Kathy and James. Stevens, Kathy,
Janice,
and James Dean. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Ted Stevens. I'm the Director of Senior and Disabled Services with Lane Council of Governments. I do have written testimony, but I think because many of the points that I wanted to make today have already been made by prior speakers, I just wanted to lend my voice of support for Senate Bill 833. The agency that I work with has been involved with Senator Walker for about the last 2.5 years working on this bill. We worked with her when she was a member of the House of Representatives, and certainly worked with her again in the interim between the 2001-2003 period to try and bring a bill to you, hopefully that would be workable as well as compromising the various interest groups that are involved in this question. And I think with that, I will stop just in the interest of time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Kathy.
Oh, all right.
Start off.
Well, Chair Nelson and committee members, my name is Catherine Jeunesse, although I go by Kathy. I live in Lowell, and I'm a volunteer member of the Lane Council of Governments, the Disability Services Advisory Council. And I ask that you support the concept of visitability by passing Senate Bill 833 out of your committee with a do pass recommendation. And as a disability advocate, I have helped to encourage people with disabilities to be out and active in their community. And as the chairperson of the Lane Council of Government Special Transportation Fund, I've advocated for funding to help improve transportation access for seniors and people with disabilities. The freedom to travel opens up the world to people who are otherwise homebound. They are not dependent on others to visit their doctor or buy their groceries. Unfortunately, seniors and people with disabilities are oftentimes unable to visit those closest to them, family and friends. Access to visit relatives and to socialize with friends often ends at the stairway to their home. There is an alternative, visitability. By making simple modifications in new home construction, including an entrance with no steps and an entry and a bathroom door wide enough for a wheelchair to pass through, we can open up the worlds of many, many people. An isolation at home need not be the norm, but we need to change the way we think. The cost to modify a home to become visitable is under $1,000. I believe that this is a small price to pay to help ensure that people are able to take an active part in society. How does that affect me? There are so many examples from a lifetime of a disability of being unable to visit other people's homes. My home in Lowell is accessible. I have always been the one to adapt my environment, and I have been very inventive in adaptations. I have relied on family, friends, church members, and even strangers to help me get into a house. When my daughter Kristen graduated from high school, she asked that the party be held at her stepmother's home. I could not enter from the front door because of a set of stairs, so I wheeled into the backyard. And a couple of people hefted my scooter onto the deck and then into the house. Because my mobility is limited, my daughter Kristen accompanied me to the bathroom and to the kitchen. And a lack of visitability has substantially limited my independence. And I have encountered this repeatedly. My daughter, who is accompanying me today, has an apartment that I can get into, but to get into the bathroom, I can just barely fit one. This is my old scooter. But my new scooter, I cannot get it through the doorway. So, and I have taken a fall or two in her apartment. As I wheel around the Capitol, I see a lot of temporarily able-bodied, which I refer to as TABs. It can be a major production for a person who uses a wheelchair to get to the Capitol to testify. Please don't let the existing isolation of people with disabilities represent a lack of interest in this topic. On the contrary, please realize that we are here today to represent thousands of Oregonians who are isolated in their own homes, unable to speak to this committee on their own behalf. I urge your support of Senate Bill 833, and I'm glad to answer any of your questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Kathy. Appreciate you coming now. James?
My name is James Dean. I chair the Eugene Human Rights Commission, which has voted in favor of the visibility bill and has also sent a recommendation to the City Council of the City of Eugene. You have the facts and figures about this bill. There's no reason to repeat those. The main reason we have passed this recommendation is because it's the thing to do. Looking into the future, accessibility and visibility need to merge into one access for everyone, everywhere. And that's the main aspect of this bill.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Any questions for this panel?
No, I want to just thank them all for coming.
Yes, thank you very much. We do appreciate that. Norton. Cable, Kim Cabell, Phil, Cabell, excuse me, sir. Phil Donovan, are you in here? And Laura Woodruff.
Senator Nelson, members of the committee, my name is Norton Cabell. I'm a private landlord with property in Eugene and Springfield. I'm the past president of a statewide landlord trade group. I both teach and write in the industry. I'm active in affordable housing issues down in Eugene. I chair the city's Community Development Block Grant Advisory Committee, and I sit on the same Intergovernmental Housing Policy Board that John Van Landingham chairs. I live in Eugene. In fact, I'm a constituent of Senator Walker's. I agree with her on many issues, but this is not one of them. It's difficult to oppose this bill when we look at who's sponsoring it and who's going to benefit from it. In fact, I have a death wish. The last time I came and testified before the legislature was for Jerry Bieberle's memorial mandatory Section 8 bill last session, and I barely escaped that room with my flesh unflayed, with there were so many landlords there to oppose me. It's difficult to oppose this bill, but nonetheless, this one, like Leave No Child Behind and Eradicating Hunger, it's just not that simple. I can cite a lot of reasons to oppose the bill. There are issues of design, of security and privacy, of blending housing into the neighborhood, of no longer being able to build townhouses. Aging in place sounds good. But in Eugene, anyway, we build affordable housing, the housing affected by this bill. We aim most of it for families with children. How many people who live in rental housing who are in their 20s and 30s are, practically speaking, going to age in place in that same housing? I submit that it's a minuscule number. I want to focus, though, and I want you to focus on the money. Proponents argue that the costs are minimal, but any additional cost to these developers is significant. The design compromises necessary to make that flat entrance into every unit and wider hallways and the like will in many cases mean one or more fewer units on a given site. Ask the architects and developers. I have. Since over 50% of any project's costs are fixed costs, that means that the overall the cost of the remaining units can increase 3 to 5% or even more. And that's significant, I know. Again, as a member of the Housing Policy Board, where we evaluate proposals for using public money to build affordable housing, the very housing affected by this bill, I anyway scrutinize those proposals trying to get the biggest bang for the buck. And this housing is already very expensive, and Senate Bill 833 is just going to make it more so. Bob Repine testified how we've taken other sort of issues and incorporated them, but he was talking about safety issues, glass windows and the like. Well, this is not a safety issue here. We're talking about a convenience issue. And let's face it, affordable housing is a zero-sum game. There won't be any more money to pay for housing, to pay for these additional requirements. This bill will mean fewer units will be built. What might otherwise have been a 30-unit project, for instance, may now just be 29. Making units in a given development visible for folks in wheelchairs will mean one or more families won't be able to move into affordable housing. Our poorest citizens, those who most need affordable housing, will be the ones who will bear the cost of this bill. Thank you.
Does the fact that it's been amended to make it the...
The costs have been well reduced. But, you know, I think it was Kathy mentioned $1,000. You know, $1,000 makes a big difference. And I submit it will be more than that in many cases. But it's if it costs one unit in a 30-unit project, is that worth it? I submit that it's not.
Yeah.
But that's because I'm an advocate for affordable housing.
Well, I appreciate it. That's what this is all about, is people with differing points of view.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities. There are 22 housing authorities located around the state. We provide affordable housing, and we've, in fact, built visitable housing, and it is not without its challenges. But when this legislation was brought forward, everybody looked at it and said, it's a good idea, but how can we do it so that we can still meet our mission, which is to provide affordable housing, and there's a real dearth of that around. Waiting lists are long, and we're particularly guarded about building mandates because they do tend to increase costs. Having said that, the inclusive process that was brought forward to draft this legislation for this session basically goes a long ways towards mitigating the costs that have been articulated here. Much of what can be done to provide for visible doesn't cost any money with some awareness and with some planning, and those are good things. There are other things that definitely cost money, and we talked about those, or John Van Landingham spoke to those with regards to powder rooms and whether you can put them where they're usually designed to be put. Under this legislation, we're better off. We can continue to provide visitable, or we can provide more visitable housing. And it may cost some more. It obviously doesn't provide all the visibility that advocates are requesting, and that's kind of the genesis of compromise and why it's a good bill. So we're here today to ask for this committee's support for the inclusion of the Dash 1 amendments and to move this legislation. And then together we can help figure out, you know, how to make these things fit in the community. How can they be cost-effectively produced? And how can we continue to help address human needs? So with that, we appreciate your support for the legislation.
Thank you. Laura.
Hi, Senator Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Laura Woodruff. I live at 6705 North Seneca in Portland. And as baby boomers age, the need for accessible housing is growing more obvious. As new housing is being built involving state and federal money, it seems that since disabled people also pay taxes, we should also be able to visit friends in their homes. With the passage of the Olmstead Act several years ago, disabled people earned the right to live in the most integrated setting. Should we also have to earn the right to be able to visit our friends in their homes? In my neighborhood of St. John's, new houses are being built on 25-foot lots. The community doesn't like these homes, and they're tired of them being built. With four new homes just completed at the end of my street, we now have kids playing in our yards and in the streets, and it's forcing the longtime residents of the neighborhood to build fences to keep the kids out of our yards. Why? Because the greedy builders wanted to squeeze four houses on what should have been two lots. With visitability in place, there still might not be a bedroom on the first floor, but it might change the layout of new housing. The St. John's Lombard Plan has had the City of Portland and area residents working together to come up with a plan for future housing. Visitability would allow young families to care for an aging parent or for a family member that becomes disabled, heaven forbid. When building homes, whether publicly funded or privately funded, we are thinking about the future of all Oregonians. Oregon has always been a leader when it comes to disability access. I hope this national trend continues. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Mr. Krabbel for coming up and expressing an opinion different than mine, but we do agree on other things, so thank you.
I mean, your issue is, that is a crucial issue. When you're talking about affordability, this is a choice that we have to make.
Recognize the cost.
Recognize the cost.
And I think, Mr. Chair, we've gone a long way toward bringing that cost down to a very reasonable level. Mr. Donovan testified.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Jacqueline Zimmer-Jones.
Mr. Chair, she doesn't like to testify before 11 p.m. Can we hold her testimony for about 8 hours?
Yeah. Please introduce yourself. Speak from the heart.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jacqueline Zimmer-Jones, and I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, here to wrap up the testimony today on Senate Bill 833. And I want to start out by thanking the committee for hearing this bill. And also I want to thank the numerous organizations that have this year chosen to support this particular position, even with the amendments that are in the bill. It doesn't go quite as far as we would like it to go, but we do appreciate the support of the other members of the Housing Lobby Coalition. I want to do give you a little bit of information. You had a chance to look at the pictures that we submitted? Okay, I appreciate that. And one of the reasons that we bring that to you is because there has been an issue about whether or not we're building exemplary housing, and the Housing Authority authorities and others have said that public housing should be exemplary, and by that I felt it meant that we should lead by example, but instead I guess what the definition really pertained to was whether or not these particular housing units would fit in with existing housing, and whether we would be stigmatizing folks that live in public housing if we built them to visitability standards. And I think that the photos that we've brought forward to you today show that these do in fact blend in with neighborhoods, and you will, based on the population demographics, you'll be seeing more and more, I think, just independent housing that's built to visitability standards as people think ahead about aging in place. Mr. Norton, who has incredible credentials, came up and spoke in opposition, and I want to talk a little bit about some of the points that he made. We are, in fact, building for the population that is coming. There are over 400,000 disabled Oregonians. Right now, there are almost 570,000 seniors over the age of 60. So you're building for, technically, you could be building for about a third of the population of Oregon if you were to design all homes to this standard today. And the beauty of this particular bill is that it's sort of prevention versus damage control. If you build these homes and all homes to these standards, you don't have to go back and, one, either retrofit or, two, move in order to age in place. No one chooses to have a disability, so it can be very random, and we're all, as others have said, we're able-bodied today, but, you know, tomorrow's another day. So if you look at the statistics that we brought you on population, you can see that we are, in fact, building for an existing population. I think if there is one less unit, I'm sorry that there's one less unit. I'm sure that that generates some income somewhere, and maybe we're denying someone housing. I imagine that's a possibility. I think that's an extreme possibility. One less unit that, in exchange for dignity and independence, I think is an acceptable exchange to me. The one piece of the bill that's troublesome is that the powder room is no longer accessible to someone in a wheelchair. And if you think about perhaps your parent having a stroke and you wanting to take care of them, there are limitations to not having accessible restrooms. But I think it's basically people's independence and dignity are there's just no price tag you can put on that. So having someone come over and visit, but then having them cross a parking lot in the rain to get to the community center to use the restroom is, in fact, a safety issue in my book, and I think it should be in yours as well. Mr. Norton issued some concerns about safety, and I think that traveling to someone's home that's not accessible and trying to get a wheelchair up just the slightest bump is dangerous. If you tip someone out of a wheelchair, their injuries could be severe. They may not even be completely aware of what their injuries are, depending on what kind of feeling they have in their body. So I think safety is an issue the other way, and would like you to consider that. So with that, I want to, again, thank you for your time and stand for any questions you might have, and thank Senator Walker for continuing to champion this issue. I think that maybe 20 years from now we'll look back on this and wish we'd have gone as far as possible on this, and maybe in a couple of years we'll pat ourselves on the back for being bright enough to proceed.
Questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the handout, I guess your handout, your name's on the handout.
Yeah.
Just curious, on the back, I think the stat you wanted us to see is disability status, civilian. And could you define for me what that means? I mean, how are disabilities categorized? I mean, there are obviously different levels of disability.
Correct. Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe that what we're talking about is impaired in one or two activities of daily living. So there's an activities of daily living scale that is used. It's a ubiquitous scale used everywhere to define what people's disabilities are. Surprisingly enough, with back back impairments, back pain, back those sort of issues can be an activity of daily living that can cause you to be impaired and limit your mobility. If you've ever thrown your back out and shuffled around or injured your back at work, that sort of thing. So it just means whether or not you can participate in life at the same level that others can. And if you'd like, I could bring you something that details that a little more.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just was trying to get an example because, for instance, it says the population 65 or older percent with a disability is 41.5%. And I was trying to get a feel for what that means. Obviously, not those people aren't confined to wheelchairs.
No, they're not. They're not all confined to wheelchairs. And this certainly doesn't just mean wheelchairs. It could mean temporarily impaired. It could mean someone who uses a walker. It could mean someone who uses a cane. And as you know, as you age, maybe your depth perception and your vision itself isn't as good. Navigating stairs three stairs can keep somebody from going somewhere. So.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Any questions? If we have no further witnesses, so we'll close the public hearing and open up a work session on Senate Bill 833, the amendments, the -1 amendments.
Yes, Mr.
Discussion
Chair.
About that.
I'd like to recommend that we pass the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 833.
They basically replace the entire bill.
Pretty much.
Except for the preamble, and not really.
Yeah, let me pull them out.
Mr. Chair, I guess going through this, I would not say it's an accurate characterization to say they replaced the entire bill. It's not a gut and stuff.
No.
It's a changing of the meaning of parts of the bill, but most of the bill remains intact.
Okay, and so the change of the meaning basically is you're just limiting it to a certain type of housing?
Well, we had done that, Mr. Chair, at the beginning, but there were actually quite a few technical changes, and if you'll notice, there were some changes to change something from visible to visitable, and there were some other changes that were negotiated. And Mr. Van Lanningham could tell us anything more than what I've just told you.
Any further questions on the amendment? They have some exemptions at this point that weren't in there in the first bill. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Does not apply to farm worker housing located on the farm.
Right. So Senator Beyer doesn't have to worry about building visitable housing on his Christmas tree farm.
No farm worker housing on this
farm. Okay. Any other questions or comments or concerns with the amendments? Senator Walker has moved the -1 amendments. Is that correct?
Yes, I have, Mr. Chair.
Any comments, discussions? So ordered. Senator Walker?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move Senate Bill 833 as amended to the floor with a soup-pass recommendation from this committee that works so very hard.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions, any discussions on the motion? To move Senate Bill 833 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? So ordered.
Can't carry to that bill, can you?
Okay, we'll open up a.
And Mr. Chair, do you mind if I carry that bill?
You can carry that bill. Open up public hearing on Senate Bill 826. Mr. Dodson.
Senate Bill 826 requires Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules setting fees for registration of securities and licensing of broker-dealers, investment advisors, and salespersons. Requires Director to set fees in amounts equal to national midpoints for similar fees charged by all other state securities regulators. Specifies a January 1, 2004 operative date, declares emergency effective on passage, and has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. No revenue impact, and may have a fiscal impact. No state has been issued.
Senator Beyer, just before we get to that, Senator Beyer has indicated in Senate Bill 833 that there's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Oh, Mr. Chair, could I respond from here?
Yes.
I spoke to the Senate President's office about that, and there was no, he said that we could rescind that referral if there was no fiscal impact.
We should send it to his office, though, to get his permission.
As we've done earlier today.
So, I guess we'd have to go back and open up the work session on Senate Bill 833 and amend the passage to indicate that there would be a referral prior to sending to the floor to the way to the president's office to rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move that we reconsider the motion by which we passed Senate Bill 833 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We have to bring the bill back before us. We reconsider the bill.
Okay. Senator Metzger has moved that we have to bring the bill back for reconsideration. Any discussion on his motion?
No.
Not so ordered. Now we can move.
Yeah. So, well, you're up down there, so you can't do that. So, Mr. Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 833 to the President's desk, 833 as amended, to the President's desk with a recommendation that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded and then sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Metzger is so moved. Any questions or discussion on the reconsideration?
Just one question. Have the amendments been to the fiscal staff, and have there been a fiscal issued on amendments?
No, they're not.
So there are not. So we're not. It says, because it says minimal fiscal, no statement issued. We don't necessarily know that yet on the amendments.
Okay.
So I guess I continue to support moving the bill forward, but I guess with the understanding that if the fiscal does come back, that there is not minimal fiscal, and in fact there is some ways or some general fund dollars required, the bill should still go to Ways and Means.
Yeah. I guess Mr. Chair, I guess the President thinks if we could ask that he hold the bill until we get the fiscal and make sure.
Is that good?
I'm okay with that. I don't think we'll see a change at all. They're mostly technical changes.
Okay. So ordered. All right. Reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 826. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I've asked Patricia Lochnikar, Chief of the Licensing and Registration of the Finance and Corporate Securities Department, to come up and assist me in this bill. This is the bill you've all been waiting for. This is the fee bill. And I think this bill has been interesting because all session you've heard me ask people when they come before our committee, how much do you pay in fees? And we've had everything from an architect pays $100 to register, a pawnbroker pays $350, and in my notes here you'll see that $205 for a plumber. Yet, when you ask a stockbroker to register in the state of Oregon, it's $15. It's a mere $15. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have not raised our fees since 1969. They have been at the lowest of the 52 jurisdictions, and I've given you quite a bit of detail, and the department was kind enough to provide me with charts, and Mr. Chair, you're the only one with color. it's too expensive to copy color. No wonder the governor asked departments not to spend money on color copiers anymore. But these charts are fascinating for you to see where Oregon is on the bottom of the list. And what I would like to say to you that is that we have a chance here to bring those fees up to a median level, a median national level, to bring money into the general fund and to actually have people pay fees that are commensurate with the rest of the country. And I'm not here to gouge the industry and ask them to pay huge amounts of fees. And in fact, several folks have called my office. I wanted to thank the department today because they sent me an email and asked me if they would like them to try to make contact with people who could be impacted by this bill. And I thought, fleetingly for a moment, no, let's try to get this under the radar screen. Let's try to blow this one through and let it, anybody not know about it. But I don't operate that way. So I asked the department to contact as many people as possible, and we did get quite a few responses, and you'll see a few folks are here in the audience today. And I did get a call this morning from the Securities Industry Association, and they are neutral on this bill, and they appreciated that we placed a call to their office. There are others who called my office and said, well, we don't really want our fees to be raised. Nobody likes their fees to be raised, but we're okay. And I think that's interesting because other states are doing the same thing. They're taking a look at their fees across the country and how they compare, and you'll see that Oregon is very, very low. One of the things that you'll also see in your packet at the very end that is unstapled, you'll see on this document here how much Oregon can raise by raising these fees. Currently, the current fee is almost $2 million that we bring in. If we raise it to the national median, it would be almost $6 million. That money goes into the general fund. That money is used by the department to administer the program, and that money is also used for investigation. And the last thing in your packet is an article out of the Oregonian about a gentleman named Cleburne Jr., Brigham Jr., otherwise known as CJ. This gentleman was a scam artist from the get-go. He had many problems. In fact, I think he recently had his sentencing hearing just last week. And he had problems as a securities dealer, a mortgage broker, and several problems. And one of the issues we had with CJ is being able to spend the money appropriately to investigate him as well as other people in his shoes. It was only when he filed bankruptcy that he finally got caught. Because let me tell you, as a person who's worked in bankruptcy court for almost 20 years, the federal government is not short on money. They're not short on going after the bad guys. So you mess around with a bankruptcy trustee, and they're going to make sure they get money into the estate, because the trustee gets a percentage of all funds that are brought into the estate. Plus, they also have a fiduciary duty. Beyond that, I simply want to state that Oregon's fees are among the lowest in the country. One of the things that I don't like about our statutes is that we'll set fees in statute, and then we don't have any ability to raise or lower those fees according to the market. By setting the fees at the national median and then allowing the department by rule to adjust those fees gives greater flexibility to these fees. It also gives an opportunity for the industry to come in and during the rulemaking process and have input on the fee increases. So I think that's one of the important reasons that we should be looking at increasing these fees. And there's a three-page talking points there for you. We can increase the flow of money to the general fund. We can go after the bad guys and women. And we can just do better for Oregonians all the way around. And I have Ms. Lochnikar here to answer any technical questions that you might have about any of the charts that we've provided. We've given you a comparison of all the securities registration fees around the country, and you'll see that Oregon is consistently at the bottom of the list. And what's truly fascinating is to look at these charts and see Oregon way down here in terms of its fees. And then you have the state of Texas, where our president is from, way up here. They have very high fees in Texas. We don't propose to go that high. We propose to stay at the median. And that's what this bill does.
Thank you. Questions?
Great bill.
Did you have anything you'd like to add? And, of course, Mr. Chair, the department is neutral on this bill because it is not in the governor's recommended budget. Am I correct on that? And they're here only to assist me in technical matters.
Very good. Happy to hear that. Okay, we have Peter Cole and John Carr. Thank you, folks, for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon. My name is Peter Toll. I'm the president of the Financial Planning Association of Oregon and Southwest Washington. We have you have a statement that I have prepared, a little one sheet in front of you. My notion is to go through that very briefly and quickly, then to turn it over to John Carr, the attorney, who is our chairs our Government Relations Committee, and as much and as best as we can to work with you all to help craft a bill that serves everyone's needs. The Financial Planning Association is the leading planning organization in the state. More than three-quarters of its members are certified financial planners. That means they have gone through extensive training, including ethics, and have a series of licenses. And those same percentages are true of our national rolls, 29,000. Certified financial planners and others in the financial planning field advise their clients on the full range of financial products and services: investment portfolio construction and management, insurance and risk management, tax implications, estate planning, personal financial planning, and related activities. As such, they are affiliated with broker-dealers and registered investment advisor firms and insurance companies. I myself, for example, have five licenses through the state of Oregon for the work that I do as a professional financial planner, and I'm licensed in six states. These professional people, our members and others in the field, will be directly impacted by the bill. We're aware that Oregon's current fee structure is among the lowest in the country. It is our understanding that increasing the fees to the national midpoint, as the bill proposes, could easily double the fees our members now pay. When we look at that in a relative standpoint, and we talk to someone who works in this building year-round, and we ask them what they pay for parking, and what they pay for parking here in Salem may be a lot different than what they pay for parking in Texas or in New York City. And I think we want to bear in mind that while the national midpoint may be at that an easy target, it also may be a little extreme for some of our members. Our industry, as you know, is currently suffering through the third year of a major slump. We're in a difficult position. By increasing fees, will we be forcing people out of the business? And I appreciate a $15 fee up to $30 or $40 won't necessarily force someone out of the business, but the combined passel could, I'm told. Will this add insult to injury, so to speak? At the same time, we feel it is our duty as responsible Oregon citizens to help pay our fair share of the financial burden required for the state to properly regulate us. Therefore, our sense is to willingly support the bill with a certain reluctance, provided that the figures, when actually amended into the bill, so we have a better sense of hard numbers, are not excessively onerous. We would be very pleased to work with the committee and with Senator Walker in helping resolve this. I would be glad to answer any questions, or we can just turn it over to John.
Turn it over to John.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Carr. As Mr. Toll informed you, I am a lawyer in private practice in Lake Oswego, resident of West Lynn. But my practice focuses on the attorneys and staff of my firm. We focus in the area of registered investment advisors. We have over 100 registered investment advisors in Oregon, some in Washington, some in Idaho, yes, even in Texas where the fees are extremely high, and some in California. So I also sit as a volunteer, like Mr. Toll, on the FPA local chapter board here. I know there's a letter written on March 26th to Senator Walker, and I believe you've seen that, Senator Walker, from the Financial Planning Association. If you're not aware, it's on the file. I would like, on behalf of the FPA National, I've been asked to read that into the record here today, and with your indulgence, I will do that.
I'd rather not read it. Just,
okay. Okay.
If you put it in, it will be part of the record.
Okay. It's been okay. I'll make it. I'll move that. That is made part of the record. We have concerns. Mr. Toll did state them. There are concerns about over. It's not just the fees as an investment advisor representative or a representative, registered representative for a stockbroker. There are all kinds of other fees that these individuals have to pay and licenses to have to keep up. There's a certified financial planning fees, the annual dues for that. There's certain insurance licensures. And if you're an investment advisor, which is a different than a registered rep for a broker-dealer, say a Merrill Lynch or Payne Webber, you're going to be paying dual fees already just to be a part of that, a part of both clubs, so to speak. So it's not just the $15 fee or the other somewhat low fees, admittedly low fees here that Oregon investment advisors and investment advisors' representatives pay, but there are other fees, and they keep. They keep piling on. Just this last year, the investment advisor registration depository, the IARD, which all investment advisors are having to move to register on, they instituted a new fee schedule, $45 annually for individuals licensed, and $100 annually for the firms. And also, there's annual updates up to $1,100 in fees that must be paid on an annual basis, and that is on top of the state fees, so that must be made clear. Some questions, and it was made somewhat clear by Senator Walker's testimony, and maybe it can be clarified a little bit with Ms. Lochnikar's with her office. But there's reference here in Section 4 of the proposed bill to a midpoint, and frankly. The North American Securities Administrators Association's Council, my office, and I, we can't figure out what the midpoint is. I mean, you could take the chart that you may have been provided that was on the website for the IARD system for, say, investment advisors and investment advisor firms, and plug that all into a calculation or figures and come up with, say, a median that I heard Senator Walker refer to. The point, in fact, there's no such thing as a midpoint, or I'm unaware of any midpoint, and maybe that's a definitional thing. But I want to make clear that we want to work with the committee, but it is difficult times. It's almost 3 years and a week or so since the stock market has had its decline, and with the war, with the economy, especially here in the Northwest, being severely hampered, we want to work with the committee to craft maybe an appropriate raise, realizing that it has not been raised since 1969, but maybe not the national midpoint or the median, maybe something in between. You also have to remember, as registered investment advisors, these people are deriving their income from a percentage of assets they manage for clients, not on commissions, not on, okay, I make a trade for this client, clear it through here, and I get X amount, a percent. Investment advisors derive their fees basically from the percentage of assets under management. And even if they've been adding clients, because people are not investing themselves as much anymore, the assets under management for these folks with this 3-year decline has gone down, and their income has gone down. I open it up for any questions that you may have.
Yeah. What is the fee for an investment advisor or a fee?
Well, there's different fees. Registered investment advisor, you mean the firm or the advisor representative? Okay, sure. For a state registered investment advisor, the registration is $100. Mm-hmm. For the renewal, there's a $50 fee. And the state-based, for the record also in your edification, state-based investment advisors, generally speaking, are investment advisors that have $25 million or less under management for clients. If you're $25 million or more, there's a 25 to 30 kind of window, then you would be registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, even albeit you'll still have to pay the fees to be registered here in Oregon. There's notice filing fees for out-of-state folks, but to give you, Senator Metzger, the The notice filing fees for out-of-state investment advisors that have five or more clients in Oregon is, I believe, $100, and then renewals, $50. And then for investment advisor representatives, point of fact, it is $15 a year and initially. And those are the people that work for the investment advisory firms. Say the stockbrokers that are working for, or the equivalent would be the stockbrokers working for Merrill Lynch or Payne Webber.
There's a $15 there.
They're as an individual to have their ticket to work as a registered investment advisor representative for an investment advisory firm is $15 a year.
I think, if I may, Mr. Chair, for clarification, a registered investment advisor is a firm. And there's someone else, I believe, who's going to testify to the firms. We represent individual members or small business people. And as I said, I have five licenses, and I work for American Express Financial Advisors specifically, which is a registered investment advisor, so I pay a fee there. It's also a broker-dealer, so I pay a fee there individually with my own business.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Toll, nice to see you again. It's been many years. Couple of questions. Of the six states that you have licenses in, what are the highest fees and what are the lowest fees?
I think Ohio is the lowest, and Florida is the highest. I'm just going from memory. I didn't look at my states before we came down. I'm also licensed in Montana, which is it's higher than Oregon in my memory.
Okay. And Mr. Carr, you testified, and Mr. Kirk and I just keep rolling since we're kind of running over. You testified that other fees they have to pay already. Don't you have to pay other fees in other states also besides your registration fees?
Certainly. Yeah.
Okay. So that's not anything unusual to Oregon.
No, if you have a CFP designation and you're also a registered representative for broker-dealer, no matter which state, except for possibly Wyoming, although I think they may be starting to regulate state-based investment advisors. Yes, that is true.
Okay.
That is true.
And gentlemen, would you both agree that 1969 is more than 30 years ago?
Certainly.
Yes, sir.
And would you both agree that that's a pretty long time to have a static fee?
Seems like it to me.
Sure.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate that answer.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Very good. Thank you. Let's see. We have one more witness. The best for the last. Roger Martin. Batting cleanup.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm testifying in opposition, not batting cleanup, Mr. Chairman, to Senate Bill 826 on behalf of the Investment Company Institute. The Investment Company Institute is a national association in the American investment company industry. There's about 9,000 members, talking mainly about mutual funds. The Institute opposes Senate Bill 826 for a number of reasons, and I'd like to enumerate some of them. The bill imposes increases of as much as 300% over existing fees. The three fees that are a particular concern to us are those imposed on mutual funds, which are federally registered investment advisors and representatives of federally registered investment advisors. You can see from the handout in front of you, these increases are in excess in relation to the current fees. The amount of Oregon fees should be tied to the cost of regulation, and I want to emphasize that. In every industry that's been talked about here, we set fees based on what it costs to regulate the industry. If you ask the people here from the Securities Division of the State of Oregon, they collect enough funds presently to cover the costs of all the regulation they are required to do. In fact, they turn some back to the general fund. So I think we're viewing something that is strictly an attempt to raise money for the general fund of the State of Oregon. Our concerns with the state imposing this increase on mutual funds and federally registered investment advisors are compounded by the fact that the fees are paid to Oregon by mutual funds and federally registered investment advisors are not registration fees. Instead, they are notice filing fees. A notice filing fee is a cursory filing with the state that involves no substantive review whatsoever. The state authority over mutual funds and federally registered investment advisors is limited to 2 points, imposing cursory notice filing amendments on such entities and investigating and bringing enforcement actions with respect to fraud and deceit. Consequently, Senate Bill 826 asks advisors to pay more for the privilege of doing business in the state, regardless of the state's limited involvement. Number three, Oregon's fees should not be based on Oregon's sister states. We're not aware of any state in the nation that attempts to set their fees based on what other states are doing. They set them on what the requirements are for the supervision in the state. Fourth, the security industry already subsidizes Oregon state government. I mentioned we collect more money now than we need for this. We're paying our fair share. The sponsor of the bill mentioned that this would raise $4 million. I would suggest to you that the problems that you and the legislature have with the general fund of the state of Oregon is not going to be substantially affected by this. But what you are doing is imposing fees on an industry that is flat on its back and has been for a number of years. If you go through some of the investment, the security dealer's offices in Portland, you'll find a lot of empty desks. And I'm not sure that we would be looking at any particular industry and saying we ought to double your fees right now because you're doing so well. I could accept something like this perhaps if it was flush, but that's certainly not the case. I have been in this building for a number of decades since before 1969. And I learned one thing in serving on revenue committees. Taxes in Oregon ought to be based on broad-based low-rate taxes, and I would suggest to you this is the opposite. It's a tax based on a very select part of the industry, and I would hope the committee would not go forward with the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions?
Yes.
Nobody wants to take a shot at you. Senator Masculine.
Mr. Martin, just curious. It's ironic because right before I came into committee, I had to stop at the payphone and call my broker, Charles Schwab, to buy 1,000 shares of Atmel, which cost me $29.95. And I don't think, since I was an electronic transaction that I did, that fee was necessary to pay for the transaction. But, you know, that's what Charlie wants. So, and I do believe we're going to be hopefully raising some registration fees to pay for some additional roads, even though that will more than cover the cost of actually of producing that document. So we don't always have fees directly related to enforcement of the particular item. I mean, we also have fees to generate revenue. That's why what Charlie was doing and everyone else. And I don't necessarily see the parallel with the state either.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, well, I would suggest to you that when it comes to the registration fee for vehicles, it ought to be higher than it is, and we still are desperately low when it comes to transportation. As far as Charles Schwab's fee, he's in the profit business. This is kind of putting the state into the profit business. Going back, we ought to raise more money in this state. I have no objections to that. I'm going to testify in the House in a few days on the proposed sales tax that they're suggesting there. But again, I go back to they ought to be broad-based taxes based on the entire segment of the population and not on specific industry-pointed things.
Although, can I ask one other thing? Just because we have a good friend here. You were here in 1969. I want to check the record and see if, Mr. Martin was, partially responsible for the last time we raised this fee. That's been a while.
It's been a while, Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger. I can't remember that 69 thing. In fact, I'm now challenged enough to go back and find out if fees haven't been changed in between. I've represented portions of the investment industry for the last 20 years, and we've certainly dealt with fees in the past. Maybe not the registration fees for stockbrokers, but here I'm talking about investment companies such as mutual funds, of which there are only about 6 in the state of Oregon. One of the problems with overregulation of this industry is it's fledgling at best in Oregon. We have representatives, security dealers that work for the various national firms. Well, we have a very limited financial market of the state of Oregon, and we ought to be encouraging it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Watt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Martin, I'm looking at your list, and it's so dramatic. when you put it in percentage terms. When you increase a fee from $15 to $50, you're showing that as a 233% increase. That sounds dramatic, does it not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, yes.
Yes, it does. But it really, from $15 to $50, it really isn't all that much, is it?
No, individual amount. You're talking down here to the advisors. I'm concerned about the mutual fund and the other filings up above that.
Well, Mr. Chair, the mutual funds would only increase by 30 to 43%, according to your testimony here. Isn't that correct?
I'm not disagreeing with that, Ms. Chairman, Senator Walker.
Okay, so you're here representing the mutual funds. Do you think we should raise the fees on everyone else?
Ms. Chairman, Senator Walker, I'll let the stockbrokers. If the Securities Industry Association told you that today, I'm going to check on that because we've represented them in the past. I find it interesting that they would say they didn't have a position on it.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Martin. I appreciate your testimony. I would like to ask two questions of Ms. Lochnikar, if we could bring her up.
Sure. Thank you. Appreciate your song.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman.
Welcome back. I thought you were going to get away, didn't you? Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patricia Lochnikar. I am the Chief of Licensing and Registration for the Securities Section in the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lochnikar, you heard the testimony earlier of Mr. Carr when he said that he didn't know how you could define the national median, and that was a concern. Do you have a response to that?
Yes, it is, Chair Nelson, Senator Walker. We are looking to get input from the industry as to where the midpoint of fees in the country actually are. We have done some internal research using methods by, for instance, taking the published list on a website for the securities industry for the fees for stockbrokers. That's a published list on the internet. There's also a published list for the investment advisor industry on the internet. That may or may not be the current fees. There may be some that have gone up. I don't think I've ever heard of fees going down. And as far as the midpoint of the fees for the registration, mutual funds, the registration of stock to be sold to the public, those kinds of fees, we basically looked at the statutes of all the other states, their statutes and their rules, and looked at what their rules and statutes said for what their fees are and put them in a list. And, you know, it's not to say that the numbers we came up with are magic. We believe that they are very close to the midpoint in the country. And we're basically looking for folks from the industry to give us feedback on whether or not we have arrived at the correct midpoint number for each individual type of fee.
Thank you, Ms. Lochnikar. So that would be a very inclusive process to determine just exactly what the national median is, and it's not rocket science. It's just communication and involvement like your department is well known for, correct?
That's correct. Thank you.
Thank you. The second question I have, Mr. Chair, is if you had more money in your program, could you investigate more fraud because you would be able to hire more FTE?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, yes, as a matter of fact, I believe my colleague, David Tatman, who is the Chief of Enforcement, basically would be very willing to hire more people. I don't know exactly what his backlog is now, but I do know that there is a backlog of cases coming in that can't immediately be assigned to staff because they have a full plate.
And, Mr. Chair, in essence, by increasing the fees, they would be tied to the cost of regulation because you could go out and investigate more fraud cases and prosecute more people who are doing bad things, correct?
Chair Nelson, yes, that is correct. Okay.
Well, I think we've just answered Mr. Martin's question. that's all I had at the moment. and I appreciate the opportunity to ask you this question. Did Senator Metzger have any?
No, at this point I'm not having any more questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. There are no further witnesses lined up, so we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 826, and I want to thank the committee for sticking with us for an extra 25 minutes. I need to have other committees to get to, and so.
And once again, they're my bill.
Your bill.
Always tell Senator Ferriola it was Senator Walker's bill.
So we'll close the public hearing on the Senate Committee on Business and Labor, and thank you very much.
I think I've got it. Okay.